Hey, what's going on? How are ya? Just checking in on ya for another episode of A Year of War and Peace podcast. The podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We're up to Book 9, Chapter 8. After his interview with Pierre in Moscow, Prince Andrew went to Petersburg on business, as he told his family, but really to meet Anatole Kuragin, whom he felt it necessary to encounter. Oh shit. It's about to hit the fan. Oh, I'm on the edge of my seat. On reaching Petersburg, he inquired for Kuragin, but the latter had already left the city. Pierre had warned his brother-in-law that Prince Andrew was on his track. Anatole Kuragin promptly obtained an appointment from the Minister of War and went to join the army in Moldavia. While in Petersburg, Prince Andrew met Kutuzov, his former commander, who was always well disposed towards him, and Kutuzov suggested that he should accompany him to the army in Moldavia, to which the old general had been appointed commander-in-chief. So Prince Andrew, having received an appointment on the headquarters staff, left for Turkey. Prince Andrew did not think it proper to write and challenge Kuragin. He thought that if he challenged him without some fresh cause, it might compromise the young Countess Rostova. And so he wanted to meet Kuragin personally in order to find a fresh pretext for a duel. But he again failed to meet Kuragin in Turkey, for soon after Prince Andrew arrived, the latter returned to Russia. In a new country, amid new conditions, Prince Andrew found life easier to bear. After his betrothed had broken faith with him, which he felt the more acutely the more he tried to conceal its effects, the surroundings in which he had been happy became trying to him, and the freedom and independence he had once prized so highly were still more so. Not only could he no longer think the thoughts that had first come to him as he lay gazing at the sky on the field of Austerlitz and had later enlarged upon with Pierre, and which had filled his solitude at Bogachurovo, and then in Switzerland and Rome, but he even dreaded to recall them, and the bright and boundless horizons they had revealed. He was now concerned only with the nearest practical matters unrelated to his past interests, and he seized on these the more eagerly the more those past interests were closed to him. It was as if that lofty infinite canopy of heaven that had once towered above him had suddenly turned into a low, solid vault that weighed him down, in which all was clear but nothing eternal or mysterious. Of the activities that presented themselves to him, army service was the simplest and most familiar. As a general on duty on Kutuzov's staff, he applied himself to business with zeal and perseverance, and surprised Kutuzov by his willingness and accuracy in work. Not having found Kuragin in Turkey, Prince Andrew did not think it necessary to rush back to Russia after him, but all the same, he knew that however long it might be before he met Kuragin, despite his contempt for him and despite all the proofs he deduced to convince himself that it was not worth stooping to a conflict with him, he knew that when he did meet him, he would not be able to resist calling him out any more than a ravenous man can help snatching at food. And the consciousness that the insult was not yet avenged, that his rancour was still unspent, weighed on his heart and poisoned the artificial tranquillity which he managed to obtain in Turkey by means of restless plodding and rather vainglorious and ambitious activity. In the year 1812, when news of the war with Napoleon reached Bucharest, where Kutuzov had been living for 2 months, passing his days and nights with a Wallachian woman, Prince Andrew asked Kutuzov to transfer him to the Western Army. Kutuzov, who was already weary of Bolkonski's activity, which seemed to reproach his own idleness, very readily let him go, and gave him a mission to Barclay de Tolly. Before joining the Western Army, which was then in May encamped at Drissa, Prince Andrew visited Bald Hills, which was directly on his way, being only 3 versts off the Solemsk High Road. The footnote here says, a provincial town, this is referring to Drissa, a provincial town situated where the river Drissa flows into the western Divina. A fortified camp had been constructed there chiefly to guard the road to Petersburg. During the last 3 years, there had been so many changes in his life. He had thought, felt, and seen so much, having travelled both in the east and west, that on reaching Bald Hills it struck him as strange and unexpected to find the way of life there unchanged and still the same in every detail. He entered through the gates with their stone pillars and drove up the avenue leading to the house as if he were entering an enchanted sleeping castle. The same old stateliness, the same cleanliness, the same stillness reigned there, and inside there was the same furniture, the same walls, sounds and smell, and the same timid faces, only somewhat older. Princess Mary was still the same timid, plain maiden, getting on in years, uselessly and joylessly, passing the best years of her life in fear and constant suffering. Mademoiselle Bourienne was the same coquettish, self-satisfied girl, enjoying every moment of her existence and full of joyous hopes for the future. She had merely become more self-confident, Prince Andrew thought. De Sales, the tutor he had brought from Switzerland, was wearing a coat of Russian cut and talking broken Russian to the servants, but was still the same narrowly intelligent, conscientious and pedantic preceptor. The old prince had changed in appearance only by the loss of a tooth, which left a noticeable gap on one side of his mouth. In character he was the same as ever, only showing still more irritability and scepticism as to what was happening in the world. Little Nicholas alone had changed. He had grown, become rosier, had curly dark hair, and when merry and laughing, quite unconsciously lifted the upper lip of his pretty little mouth, just as the little princess used to do. He alone did not obey the law of immutability in the enchanted sleeping castle. But though externally all remained as of old, the inner relations of all these people had changed since Prince Andrew had seen them last. The household was divided into 2 alien and hostile camps, who changed their habits for his sake and only met because he was there. To the one camp he belonged the old prince, Mademoiselle Bourienne, and the architect. To the other, Princess Mary, De Sales, little Nicholas, and all the old nurses and maids. During his stay at Bald Hills, all the family dined together, but they were ill at ease, and Prince Andrew felt that he was a visitor for whose sake an exception was being made, and that his presence made them all feel awkward. Involuntarily feeling this at dinner on the first day, he was taciturn, and the old prince, noticing this, also became morosely dumb and retired to his apartments directly after dinner. In the evening, when Prince Andrew went to him and, trying to rouse him, began to tell him of the young Count Kamensky's campaign, the old prince began unexpectedly to talk about Princess Mary, blaming her for her superstitions and her dislike of Mademoiselle Bourienne, who he said was the only person truly attached to him. The old prince said that if he was ill, it was only because of Princess Mary, that she purposely worried and irritated him, and that by indulgence and silly talk she was spoiling little Prince Nicholas. The old prince knew very well that he tormented his daughter, and that her life was very hard, but he also knew that he could not help tormenting her, and that she deserved it. Why does Prince Andrew, who sees this, say nothing to me about his sister? Does he think me a scoundrel or an old fool who, without any reason, keeps his own daughter at a distance and attaches this French woman to himself? He doesn't understand, so I must explain it, and he must hear me out, thought the old prince, and he began explaining why he could not put up with his daughter's unreasonable character. If you ask me, said Prince Andrew without looking up, He was censuring his father for the first time in his life. I did not wish to speak about it, but as you ask me, I will give you my frank opinion. If there is any misunderstanding and discord between you and Mary, I can't blame her for it at all. I know how she loves and respects you. Since you ask me, continued Prince Andrew, becoming irritable, as he was always liable to do of late, I can only say that if there are any misunderstandings, they are caused by that worthless woman, who is not fit to be my sister's companion. The old man at first stared fixedly at his son, and an unnatural smile disclosed the fresh gap between his teeth to which Prince Andrew could not get accustomed. What companion, my dear boy, hey? You've already been talking it over, hey? Father, I did not want to judge, said Prince Andrew in a hard and bitter tone, but you challenged me, and I have said, and always shall say, that Mary is not to blame, but those to blame, the one to blame, is that Frenchwoman. Ah, he has passed judgment. Passed judgment, said the old man, in a low voice, and, as it seemed to Prince Andrew, with some embarrassment. But then he suddenly jumped up and cried, Be off, be off! Let not a trace of you remain here. Prince Andrew wished to leave at once, but Princess Mary persuaded him to stay another day. That day he did not see his father, who did not leave his room, and admitted no one but Mademoiselle Bourienne and Tiquan, but asked several times whether his son had gone. Next day, before leaving, Prince Andrew went to his son's rooms. The boy, curly-headed like his mother, and glowing with health, sat on his knee, and Prince Andrew began telling him the story of Bluebeard, but fell into a reverie without finishing the story. He thought not of this pretty child, his son whom he held on his knee, but of himself. He sought in himself either remorse for having angered his father, or regret at leaving home for the first time in his life on bad terms with him, and was horrified to find neither. What meant still more to him was that he sought and did not find in himself the former tenderness for his son, which he had hoped to reawaken by caressing the boy and taking him on his knee. Well, go on, said his son. Prince Andrew, without replying, put him down from his knee and went out of the room. As soon as Prince Andrew had given up his daily occupations, and especially on returning to the old conditions of life amid which he had been happy, weariness of life overcame him with its former intensity, and he hastened to escape from these memories and to find some work as soon as possible. So, you've decided to go, Andrew? Asked his sister. Thank God that I can, replied Prince Andrew. I am very sorry you can't. Why do you say that? Replied Princess Mary. Why do you say that when you are going to this terrible war, and he is so old? Mademoiselle Bourienne says he has been asking about you. As soon as she began to speak of that, her lips trembled and her tears began to fall. Prince Andrew turned away and began pacing the room. Ah, my God, my God! When one thinks who and what trash can cause people misery, he said with a malignity that alarmed Princess Mary. She understood that when speaking of trash, he referred not only to Mademoiselle Bourienne, the cause of her misery, but also to the man who had ruined his own happiness. Andrew, one thing I beg, I entreat of you, she said, touching his elbow and looking at him with eyes that shone through her tears. I understand you. She looked down. Don't imagine that sorrow is the work of men. Men are his tools. She looked a little above Prince Andrew's head, with the confident, accustomed look with which one looks at the place where a familiar portrait hangs. Sorrow is sent by him, not by men. Men are his instruments. They are not to blame. If you think someone has wronged you, forget it and forgive. We have no right to punish, and then you will know the happiness of forgiving. If I were a woman, I would do so, Mary. That is a woman's virtue, but a man should not and cannot forgive and forget. he replied, and though till that moment he had not been thinking of Kurágin, all his unexpended anger suddenly swelled up in his heart. If Mary is already persuading me to forgive, it means that I ought long ago to have punished him, he thought. And giving her no further reply, he began thinking of the glad, vindictive moment when he would meet Kurágin, who he knew was now in the army. Princess Mary begged him to stay one more day, saying that she knew how unhappy her father would be if Andrew left without being reconciled to him. But Prince Andrew replied that he would probably soon be back again from the army, and would certainly write to his father, but that the longer he stayed now, the more embittered their difference would become. Goodbye, Andrew. Remember that misfortunes come from God and men are never to blame, were the last words he heard from his sister when he took leave of her. Then it must be so, thought Prince Andrew as he drove out of the avenue from the house at Bald Hills. She, poor innocent creature, is left to be victimized by an old man who has outlived his wits. The old man feels he is guilty, but cannot change himself. My boy is growing up and rejoices in life, in which, like everybody else, he will deceive or be deceived. And I am off to the army. Why? I myself don't know. I want to meet that man whom I despise, so as to give him a chance to kill and laugh at me. These conditions of life had been the same before, but then they were all connected, while now they had all tumbled to pieces. Only senseless things, lacking coherence, presented themselves one after another to Prince Andrew's mind. All right, there we go, another chapter down. And I would say, I think that might have been my favorite chapter in the book so far. It was really a joy to read. Especially after 7 chapters of Napoleon and his politics, which for me honestly dragged out a little bit, and I found it very dry and a little bit difficult to soak it all in and pay attention. To be back with familiar characters was really, really nice, but also, I don't know, Andre, his sort of complex mind, and we've seen him flip back and forth and, you know, become very volatile in his emotions from one extreme to the other, and to see him in this chapter sort of unfurl and open up, and I don't know, I just gained this really vivid understanding of the character in this chapter. And not only did I feel like I understood him really, really well, I also felt like it was a really good depiction of a particular type of depression. That sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, that dissociative depression where you're shocked at yourself for feeling so little. That when he picks up his boy and puts him on his knee, hoping that it will let him feel that same spark of love again. And then he's not shocked, but just further depressed by the fact that he can't feel love for his own kid. It's reminiscent of the kind of cycle of self-loathing. The self-loathing itself, it's almost like self-harm. It's an addiction, right? Self-harm is an addiction. Self-loathing, similarly, is a form of self-harm. And then so, weirdly enough, the thing that, I suppose, not that you enjoy, but the thing that stimulates you or the thing that engages you is the feeling of loathing yourself, hating yourself. So it's a cycle, because you hate yourself because of how depressed you are, and then you think, maybe hanging out with my kid will remind me of how good life is. And then when you fail to get that response of, you know, feeling love again, you at least get the kick of being able to say, oh, I knew I was an absolute monster. I knew there's nothing left good in me, or whatever. The feeling of self-loathing, it reinforces itself. It's almost like the self-harming person starts to get off on proving to themselves over and over what a terrible person they are. And I think it's really highlighted right at the end when he's talking about, he realizes the reason he's so angry and depressed is Kurgan. He circles back around to Kurgan and goes back to that and says that he wants to go to the army and find him. But he has this realization that the reason he wants to find him isn't so that he can hurt his enemy. It's actually so that his enemy can further hurt him, in, you know, further proving the cycle of self-loathing and self-harm. He says, I am off to the army. Why? I myself don't know. I want to meet that man whom I despise so as to give him a chance to kill and laugh at me. His self-worth has just plummeted to such a low. Terrible, terrible thing to witness, and really, really well written. This chapter was really well written. I found it had some really nice poetic descriptive language in there. Things like talking about the immutability of the enchanted sleeping castle as a way to refer to his home having not changed and the people in it not changing either. It's such a funny, that was a relatable thing, feeling too, and it's funny in that I went away to Japan for 6 months or something like that in 2009. I think it was 6 or 7 months. And I remember that coming home back to Melbourne and back to my little hometown and thinking, oh, look at that. That little milk bar shop is still there. What do you know? And like feeling like everything should have changed in those 6 or 7 months that I was gone, and being shocked that things that had been there for, you know, 25 years were still there 6 months later was... Just having the perspective of a different place makes you feel like everything should have changed back home, kind of unreasonably. So that was very relatable. I also liked little things like referencing the old prince, his father, becoming morosely dumb. Morosely dumb was a nice way to describe someone who has become quiet because they're kind of annoyed. Little things like that. I found this chapter to be quite packed with really nice language. I don't know whether we could give the credit to the translator or to the original author, but compared to the previous 7 chapters, I really enjoyed reading this one. It was interesting to see that Anatole had skipped the country, gone off to war, essentially, and I think he'd done that in order to get away from Prince Andrei, who he had been told was after him. Imagine going to war to get away from one man. And then similarly, imagine going to war just to find one man. Go to fight in a war against a whole other country just so that you can have a fight with someone from your own country. I don't know what advice I'd give someone like Prince Andrew at the moment, you know. Should he just live and let live sort of thing? And like he's chasing Andre all around the world. And I don't know, he's kind of giving a lot of power to... Oh, sorry, not Andre. He's chasing Anatole all around the world and giving a lot of power to Anatole. I guess it comes down to a question of integrity and honor are the things to consider when you try to decide what to do in a situation like this. And, you know, do you chase your enemy or leave them be? What's the more integral thing to do and what is the more honorable thing to do? Difficult to say. I think the answer to that question would change a lot depending on what culture you're from. I'd be interested to see some comments about that. In your opinion, what should a man do to the man who has stolen his fiancée? And I think no one in this day and age would say have a duel with them, but what I mean to say is, do you confront them or do you dismiss them? JMama8779 said, as much as I'd like to say see Anatole get what's coming to him, I think I'd feel less about Andre if he pursues this revenge. I love him as a character, and I hope that he can find the peace of infinite sky again before he succumbs to villainous acts. Yeah, you know what? I think you're right. I think he should go back to infinite sky, and I think the self-loathing is almost a way to attack Anatole, because there's this weird thing that happens when you want revenge on someone, that if you do get revenge, that person no longer feels guilty about what they did. They feel like you've gotten even and they can put it out of their mind. Whereas if they do feel guilty and you don't get revenge, that guilt only grows. Similarly, if you take the revenge out upon yourself by self-harming or self-loathing, that person will feel even more guilty about what they've done. So in some ways, the worst damage you can inflict on your enemy is to do damage to yourself. Strange little quirk of humanity, but something that you, if you look for it, you can see that happening in the world around you. It's quite alarming to witness. I executed an act of similar self-harm revenge when I was 13 years old, and I actually wrote this in a scene in the fictional novel that I'm writing now called Personal Fable, but it's a flashback to when the character was a kid, and I've drawn this flashback out of my own life. But basically, I'll tell you this story real quick. I was walking in the hot sun with my older brother and his mate, and my older brother's 3 years older, and so was his mate, and we were all kind of friends. But I was just kind of happy to be hanging out with the big kids, the older kids. It's a really, really hot summer day, and me and my brother had our bikes, our bicycles, but our mate didn't have a bicycle. So we were walking the long, long, long walk home. We weren't riding our bikes because we didn't want him to have to walk by himself, essentially. So we were pushing our bikes along. Anyway, I was struggling to keep up because I was, you know, a bit smaller than the other guys, a bit younger. And the sun was getting to me, and so my brother's mate kindly says, "Hey, look, I'll take the bike for you. Let me carry that for you so you can keep up a bit easier." I said, "Oh, thanks very much." So he grabs the bike for me, and then him and my brother jump on the bikes and ride off. Ride all the way home, and then there's me just standing there on the hot, ridiculously hot pavement with, you know, a few kilometers left to walk home. And I was just so angry watching them ride off and laugh. And I knew deep down that my brother would have felt extremely guilty for having done this. But, you know, I suppose peer pressure for his friend. He was trying to be cool and go along with the thing. So they rode off home, and I had to walk all the way home. I remember crying tears of anger walking home. I was furious. And when I got back home, they were sitting in the lounge room just drinking cold glasses of cordial and watching TV. And I walked into the backyard through the gate, and the bikes, my brother's bike and my bike, were, you know, just lying down in the grass in the backyard. And so I went into the shed, and I got the axe, the wood chopping axe, and I went back over to the bikes. And my first thought was, trash my brother's bike, destroy it. I was really angry. And then, but I knew my brother, and I knew that he would feel really guilty because he's actually a really good brother, and it was pretty out of character for him to ditch me. And so I knew he'd be feeling guilty, and that was my revenge. So what I did was I trashed my own bike with the axe, knowing that he seeing how much I hated myself, I suppose, would make him feel so guilty. And I hadn't gotten revenge, which meant if I had have got revenge, he wouldn't have felt guilty anymore. And I wanted to exacerbate his guilt to exact the best kind of revenge. Kind of, I don't know, what would you say that? Is that manipulative? Is it unjust? I mean, am I the bad guy in that story? I don't really know, but that's what I did. 13-year-old me. That's a story that stuck with me for a long time. Long enough to end up in the novel that I'm writing now. You enact the revenge upon yourself to exacerbate the guilt in your enemy rather than to relieve them from it. Weird little quirk of humanity. Is that what Prince Andrei is talking about there when he says he wants Anatole to kill him and laugh at him? Tough to say. Anyway, I'm a bit off track. So, Kayla. Kayla has said, "This comment isn't strictly related to this chapter, but I'm a bit mystified by what has been happening between Boreen and old Bolkonski. He seems so awful and so much older that I would assume she wouldn't want to have anything to do with him. Instead, it seems like she's completely fine with his flirtations and advances. At first, I thought it was because she was dependent on him and needed to stay in his good graces, but now it doesn't seem like that's it. Since old Bolkonski will probably die sometime soon, is she hoping to marry him in order to inherit his money and property after he dies?" JMama8779 said, "I definitely have been getting the inheritance vibe for a long time. She seems opportunistic. Can't say I fault her for it, as she never really explicitly states otherwise. I don't really get her either. How is she so happy all the time living with these two miserable people? Old man Bolkonski is, we know, very grumpy, angry, and miserable. And Princess Mary is miserable because of old man Bolkonski. And yet she's so chipper and happy all the time. It doesn't make sense to me. I hope we get a chapter where we get to see inside her head a little bit and understand where she's coming from. Anyway, I'm going to end the episode here. What a great chapter. I really hope the next chapter is as good again, because I had an absolute blast reading this one. Alright, thanks for listening. I will see you tomorrow.